Previously on Beta.
Tony Newman and Doug Phillips now tumble helplessly toward a new fantastic adventure.
I'm gonna throw this out there. I hate John Hamm. I hate his face. I hate his pig name. I hate how smug he always looks. I hate John Hamm.
Oh, you're looking for guidance from me. You're looking in the wrong place.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, director David Pryor on the trials and tribulations that went into making his debut horror film, The Empty Man.
By the time the trailer was being made, the Disney acquisition was complete. I didn't even see the trailer until the day before it came out. They released the poster and the one sheet 1 week before the film came out. It was like overtly insulting.
Also, Sandy Tan talks about her latest novel, Lurkers, and her award-winning documentary, Shirkers.
He stole this film, destroyed our lives, vanished, and then years later, I've moved to the U.S., I've grown up, I recover the footage of this lost film, and I make a film about this whole process.
But first...
It's The Late Show!
If you watch The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, then you're familiar with that voice, Jen Spira. She's the announcer on the show, and she used to be a staff writer for Colbert. Jen's also written for America's finest news source, The Onion, but now she's writing satirical short stories. Her debut collection is called Big Time. The book features a variety of comical characters, including Mr. Middlebury, a millennial pig who performs improv, a time-traveling starlet from the 1940s who tries to make her mark in contemporary Hollywood, and the world's very first influencer, a cavewoman named Ula. We caught up with Jen in her New York City home for a high-octane conversation about her stories, which she points out are often parodies of literary genres.
I love playing with genre because genre has defined guideposts and rules. And so if you know them, you can subvert them and tell a different story. So I only play with the ones that I have a deep affinity for, love for. As for writers, there's a bit of a shortcut happening. The audience already knows the world. In terms of world building, I just need to hew to the rules, but I'm not starting something new. Now, that said, the stuff that was extremely exciting to write in this is the stuff that where I'm not really playing with a specific genre. The genres themselves are so fun. And so there's just a lot of stuff to play with. And that's why I like going in there.
Mm-hmm. Is there one particular story that you're especially proud of in terms of how much you subverted the genre to tell a different kind of story?
Oh, okay, I love that question, Doug. And
Thank you.
Yeah, actually, yes. It's the title story. And it's the title story, Big Time, is a Hollywood rags-to-riches memoir. And I'm deconstructing that genre, the Hollywood rags-to-riches memoir, but telling a real story at the same time. And that was the doozy because it's by far the biggest thing that I broke off. I mean, it's a novella. It's over 100 pages. I kept pushing myself and breaking past what I'd done before. So I wrote an 8-pager. I wrote a 20-pager. A 30-pager, and then The Big Boy, and that one, basically the trick there was, okay, I want to deconstruct this genre, so I get to play with all of the genre stuff, but it's so freaking long, I have to also tell an emotionally gripping story that the reader cares about, you know? So with the short stuff, you can get by on style and jokes, but when you're asking someone to hang out for that long, it also has to be absorbing on a more fundamental story level.
Yeah, and it certainly does do that. Can you tell us a bit about your creative process in terms of how you come up with ideas and how you transform them into short stories?
Totally. The ideas start from a few different places. One would be if I'm just feeling... First of all, a lot of times it's just anger and frustration and something that I am frustrated about, angry about, or any intense emotion that I'm feeling at the time. For example, one story, when I was getting ready for my wedding, I really fell into this trap where I was trying to get super hot and I was wasting so much time on my Getting Hot project, that the kind of absurdity of that struck me as funny, that like, oh, I'm putting all this time into like being hot. That's not really what the wedding's about. That felt like an idea for something. And also much more practically and less creatively interesting, but I felt like I was wasting a lot of time outside of Colbert, my day job, writing on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. And I was like, I better get something out of all of this wasted time and it better yield some interesting material. So sometimes if I become obsessed with something and I may be wasting too much time on Zillow or wasting too much time reading about someone on Wikipedia, I'm like, I better squeeze something out of this. But so intense feelings. And then also there are certain obsessions that knock around in my brain. Curiosity. I'm trying to say curiosity.
Mm-hmm. One of the recurring motifs you use to great effect is to take something contemporary and then set it in a different time period to create that great comedy concept, the clash of context. My favorite example of this in big time is The First Influencer. Can you tell us a bit about this story?
Oh, thank you so much, Doug. I love that one, too. I wrote a lot that one on the train between D.C. and New York. Yeah, The First Influencer is a story about a friendship between two cave women. And I'm always interested in the idea of the very first time someone said a cliche, the very first time someone said a sarcastic comment. And it just, as I was thinking about that, it did occur to me, like, what was the very first time someone was cool, you know, like the first cool person. And so it was funny to think of what that person would be like in Neolithic times and how you would notice they were cool. Because of course, also, I mean, I have so many cool girl friends and I myself am so interested in the larger influencer culture that coolness, I mean, especially with social media and the prevalence and the importance of social media, you know, like it's all about being aware of cool people. And I just thought of, oh, it's funny to think of cool people back when there were only eight people, you know, that's where that came from. Yeah, I lurk a lot on Instagram. And so lurking and being obsessed with cool people gave me the idea for the story.
Yeah. Now would be the perfect time to have you read an excerpt from The First Influencer. And if you could set it up, that would be great.
I would love to. Thank you. This is a conversation between the main characters in this story, Gruga and Kruga, who are best friends. And they're kind of obsessed with this one woman in their clan, Ula. This is a conversation that Gruga and Kruga have about Ula, the cool girl in their clan. On their way to the berries, the women noticed a huge new painting on the side of the big cave. It was done in crushed ochre seed, and it depicted Ula in a skimpy loincloth, sipping tea. In the corner of the painting were four antelopes, a sparrow, three arrows, and a knife, which translated loosely to #flatbellytea, #ad. That night, Kruga and Gruga groomed their children by the fire as they watched idly for predators. "How much flint do you think she pulls in from the cave ads?" Gruga asked. "Wait a second, she gets flint for that?" Kruga said, picking a gnat egg out of her daughter's back hair. "Wake up, she gets something out of it. She's not doing the ad for free." Gruga finished wiping down her son's neck and moved on to his chest air. "Huh," Kruga said, unable to hide her admiration for a person who could turn the simple act of drinking tea into a business venture. "By the way, you look like a moron today standing there poking yourself in front of Ula. I was actually embarrassed for you." "Tell me how you really feel," Kruga thought, rolling her eyes as she rubbed her daughter's back over the sleeping pelt.
That was great. Thank you. I've read that you're influenced by classic noir films and fiction, and we here at Beta are big film noir fans, so we'd like to know which noir films and fiction have influenced you.
Oh, great. Doug, no one asked me that. That's awesome. That's awesome. Okay. Well, I mean, okay, let's see. Specifically, the title story, Big Time, I am obsessed with Barbara Stanwyck, as I know you must be too, Doug.
Yes, yes.
Okay. So
Double Indemnity.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, God. Okay. So, yeah, Double Indemnity. I mean, I've seen it a million times. I rewatched it recently. And Woody Allen did say once that it's the perfect movie. And I just couldn't agree with him on that point alone more. I'm sure, Doug, you also know about Babyface, which is one of the, you know, bigger pre-code movies. It's a movie with Barbara Stanwyck that was, I think that it's famous for being the movie that kind of broke that was so obscene that that's when they instituted the code, the morality.
Oh, the Hays Code.
The Hays Code, exactly.
Oh, so,
Oh, I haven't seen that one. It's totally just
free online. Oh, yeah, Babyface.
Okay.
It's so shockingly obscene. I mean, of course, they don't actually show things, but what they're referencing is so dark. And it is essentially, it's not a Hollywood rags to riches story. It's just a woman's rags to riches story. When I saw Babyface, I was just... I loved her transformation. It's just an incredibly ambitious, ruthless young woman who will really do anything to get ahead. And what she ends up doing in that movie is sleeping her way to the top. I just became obsessed with the idea of that character, who's so of a specific time. I mean, the Depression, being flung into the future and having to make it today with her understanding of how to get ahead and that incredibly scrappy, bootstrappy mentality kind of like merged with today's sort of self-help and self-care, weighted blankets sort of like world. I don't know. It felt like a very rich fish out of water premise that I could play with.
Mm.
In terms of noir fiction, a few things immediately jump to mind. I mean, I am pretty new to Raymond Chandler, and he's just been blowing my booty away. I mean, there's such great similes. I mean, that is the richness that you find in noir film and fiction, is the amazing metaphors and similes and the innuendo. And I'm thinking, like, there's this one line from, I think it's The Long Farewell, or Chandler, you know, the detective, Philip Marlowe's like, I belong there like a pearl onion on a banana split. And there's just a million of those, you know, and they're so simple and sweet and arresting and really imaginative. So, and then of course there's like new noir that I really like, that novel Eileen by Otessa Moshfeghi.
Yes, we've had her on the show. Yeah.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, Otessa's great, yes.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I thought that was a really cool neo-noir piece of fiction.
Mm-hmm. I certainly see the noir influence in the title story big time, which you mentioned earlier. But can you tell us a bit more about this novella?
Oh, absolutely. So it is about a 1940s femme fatale starlet who's just on the cusp of breaking out. And she had a really, really hard life. And she's worked so hard to get where she is positioned to be a star. And she ends up through a sort of supernatural happenstance getting flung into the future and wakes up on the beach in Venice in modern day LA in the middle of a bikini boot camp class and has to kind of find her bearings and figure it out and claw her way to the top today. Her name is Ruby, and you know, she goes on this crazy adventure, and on the way she learns about basically, I mean, the magic of friendship. And she's cut out her friends and made that decision to kind of be successful. Partly, I was inspired by, there's this recent biography of Barbara Stanwyck, and it talks about her rise, her early life and her rise to the top in Hollywood. And it's such a brutal, traumatizing story. And I thought it would be really, really fun to tell a story like that comedically.
Mm-hmm. And you did it so very well. I would be remiss in my journalistic responsibilities if I did not mention the Wisconsin in this novella. Your protagonist, Ruby Russell, appears on the reality show The Bachelor, and the bachelor's name is Packer Tracy, named after our beloved Green Bay Packers. How did you come up with the name and the idea for that?
Oh, okay. Well, so it's really interesting, actually, just because the guy that I based this on, Colton Underwood, is very much in the news right now, Doug. I don't know if you've seen this.
Yes, I do.
Okay, so
I've seen that.
Yeah, so he was the Virgin Bachelor. So Ruby eventually, in working her way to the top in the Now Times, ends up getting cast on a reality show, and it's The Bachelor. Colton Underwood, like, you know, he's a very sweet, innocent, kind of naive guy. I mean, he's in the news now because he just came out. Yeah, this guy Packer, he's not, in my story, the producers decide to sort of bill him as the Virgin Bachelor. And as Ruby finds out very quickly, that is all just for the show. And he is not a virgin. And they quickly begin an affair.
You used to write for America's Finest News Source, The Onion, and The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. How helpful were these writing experiences for you in terms of going on to write your short stories?
Oh, incredibly helpful, because you have to internalize a ruthlessness in your own process when you work in anything that's like a volume game. So at The Onion and The Late Show, you come in every day with a bunch of pitches, and you get very comfortable throwing them away or having them thrown away, you know, after you pitch them and they don't land. So that really habituated me to being very comfortable throwing my stuff away. And also the adrenaline of like knowing that I actually had to pitch it to Stephen Colbert's face, one of my comedy heroes. And I would actually have to say this joke to his face. That really sharpens you and makes you think, can I come up with something better than this? Because this isn't that good. And I really don't want to totally human. So that was, and that's every day, you know? So, and when you really respect the hell out of someone like that, and you really just admire them, that is, that's an awesome fire under you.
Hmm. Yeah, definitely. Were there any bad habits you acquired while writing for The Onion and Colbert that you had to unlearn when you started writing short stories?
Ooh, another great question. And the first thing that jumps to mind, it's not actually a habit. It's more like a muscle that was completely undeveloped. So the muscle that was undeveloped was something that's totally different in fiction from writing sketches for late night or articles, funny articles for The Onion, is the world-building tissue that you need to put into stories for the pacing to be right. So actually, I had to fight a few instincts. One, I had to fight the instinct to pack it with constant jokes, because that is what you—that's what you're doing on at my last job at the Late Show. And so I had to learn a new instinct of, you know, pacing and letting the reader breathe, and also letting myself end a story on a wistful or sad note, which at first to me just felt like, oh, you're being lazy. Come up with a funny closer. My instinct was to always end in a funny way, always come up with a funny closer. I had to learn that I'm in this new art form and I had different tools and I had to kind of learn them on the fly.
Yeah, and you clearly did learn them. And I love that you used the phrase world-building tissue. I've never heard that before. WBT, the acronym. We're big on acronyms on Ad Beta, so we're going to start using WBT, world-building tissue.
Oh my God, I love that.
What are you working on now?
Well, now I'm working on a few things. One, and unfortunately, some I can't really discuss too openly, but they're basically adaptations of stuff in the book.
Uh-huh. At least what we're talking streaming series, aren't we? You probably can't answer that, but I think we're talking streaming series. I was thinking about that while I was reading. So many of these would work well.
Oh, thank you so much. I mean, I did, as I was writing some of them, I was like, ooh, I really do feel like this could have a second life. So that has been fun. And then the other thing is just my next collection. And I've kind of been toggling between filling out, I can't help myself writing these short stories, but I also am interested in writing a novel. And so I've been basically making a lot of notes. There's just a huge monster document with this novel that's kind of forming. So working on those projects.
Jen Spira, it was such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us. This was great.
Doug, I really loved being here. Thank you.
Jen Spira is the author of the short story collection, Big Time. You can find out more about Jen at WPR.org/beta.
All of the rises and falls in the dialogue, which words were stressed, which ones weren't, all of it was exactly the way I had imagined it when I was writing it. And it was one of those sort of semi-out-of-body experiences.
David Pryor joins us to talk about his debut horror film, The Empty Man. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Well, so on the first night you hear him, and then you can't stop thinking about him. And then on the second night, you see him following you.
And on the third night?
Well, on the third night, he finds you.
That's a clip from filmmaker David Pryor's eerie film, The Empty Man. David got his break directing DVD special features for David Fincher films like Zodiac and The Social Network. And he obviously drew on that work experience in writing and directing his debut horror feature film. The Empty Man focuses on an ex-detective named James LaSombra. James is grieving the deaths of his wife and his son. He helps his friend Nora, whose daughter has gone missing. James's investigation leads him to a sinister organization called the Pontifex Institute, which turns out to be a cult. The film stars James Badge Dale, and chameleon-like actor Stephen Root delivers a great performance as the cult's leader.
The movie also became embroiled in a mega media merger that delayed and botched its release. The Empty Man features an impending sense of dread and doom, and themes of guilt, grief, the meaning of existence, and mind control. David joined us to talk about the troublesome production and why he wanted to include such big ideas in his film.
Some of the first memories I have of fostering my nascent passion for movies was as a five-year-old running down the driveway to the newspaper and throwing away everything except the movie ads and memorizing the credit blocks for Marathon Man. So there's something about that kind of sweaty, paranoid conspiracy thriller that was relatively common in the 70s, and the sort of shivery back of the neck fear that a really well-wrought suspense movie can give you. And I always liked those ideas. And I think part of the fun of genre is the way that it allows you to talk about deeper, serious, you know, human universal truths or ideas or common fears and things without being too precious about it. You can kind of look at it out of the corner of your eye. The way that genre allows you to literalize a metaphor and kind of come at it askance. So you can, you know, you can tell a story about guilt or greed, for example, and you can do it in a very kitchen sink sort of way where you're having characters hash out their problems and talk about their inner feelings over dinner. Or you can have a character who ends up meeting a literal green-eyed monster and just kind of take the idea and shape it a little bit differently. And in a way, it can almost be kind of the spoonful of sugar that can help the medicine go down. So I don't know. It's a proof against pretentiousness in some way, because you can talk about big ideas without actually presenting them as big ideas.
At one time, we were one. We will all be one again. This message comes to you directly from the Empty Man. He beckons you to discover the true face of the world.
And there's a kind of fun you can have while you're doing it. I mean, the visceralness of the experience, I guess, is a lot of what I like about it.
Yeah, yeah. The cult in your film operates under the name of the Pontifex Institute. What does the word Pontifex mean, and how does that relate to what happens in the film?
Yeah, I spent a lot of time trying to figure out what they should be called. So Pontifex means, in Latin, it means bridge builder. And There was a running motif of bridges in the movie, not only for their literal, I mean, just their pictorially interesting, but they're also because of their metaphoric value. So the if James's character is a man who is in a liminal space, you know, he's between two worlds, in kind of up and down the scale, you know, he is that way emotionally. He's got this kind of tragedy. He's living on his own for the first time in a long time. He's not at peace with himself. And then there's also the question of the supernatural aspect of the story. So bridges just felt like the right kind of idea to have in there. And so I wanted it to pepper through the whole thing, down to the name of the restaurant that he's in at the beginning. All the way through, there are little hints at the word bridge. And so I knew I wanted it to have a bridge element to it, but I also thought it should have something of a quasi-religious aspect to it. And I was a little bit concerned. I gave myself a little hesitation on it because of the Catholic associations with the word Pontifex. That used to be, or I don't know if it still is, a word for the Pope. It was not intended to have any overt Catholic connotation to it. And my only trepidation was that it might literalize it in some audiences' minds too much. In the end, I think it's an out-of-date word. I don't think people use it too much. And it kind of has a connotation of a group of people in a quasi-religious space trying to make a bridge between where we are and what they want to see come. And there's the kind of apocalyptic side to it as well. And it sounds good. You know, anything with an X at the end always kind of sounds good.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You picked the perfect word. The great actor Stephen Root plays the leader of the Pontifex Institute, Arthur Parsons. Can you tell us a bit about Stephen's character and his performance?
Well, yeah, Stephen is a blessing. I've been a huge fan of his for a long time. As you know,
me too, yeah.
Yeah, anybody with taste loves Stephen Root. He's great. Yeah. And because of the way that he embodies the quintessential character actor, you know, the concept of somebody who can move easily back and forth between different genres and different types of character and things. He's ridiculously funny and unbelievably menacing and really charming and capable of accessing all sides of the human animal. So when the idea of casting that character came up, I didn't have anybody immediately in mind, but I think I was talking to Denise, my casting director, and we somehow the word Stephen came up. I can't remember if it was her or me that first brought him up, but it was one of those instant light bulbs, like, oh yeah. He flew into South Africa where we shot, and he had, I think, 24 hours before he was on set. You know, the time change and everything was crazy. He was completely jet-lagged, but completely prepared, an absolute pro. And I'll tell you, the one of the most joyful moments I had making the movie, and making the movie was, no movie is a pleasure to make because there's too many troubles and too many fires to put out, but you have these moments. And one of those moments was listening to Stephen Root and James Badgedale in that scene between the two of them. And the way that Root had just kind of, without even discussing it with me beforehand, he just, all of the rises and falls in the dialogue, where the which words were stressed, which ones weren't, all of it was exactly the way I had imagined it when I was writing it. And it was one of those sort of semi-out-of-body experiences.
But when was the last time you really thought about that? What is an abyss? And if you stare into it, why? What about it calls to you? And if it stares into you, it stands to reason something in you must also be calling to it. And that, my friend, is anything but harmless.
But one of the things I like most about The Empty Man is the way it explores the idea of what is reality. And this, of course, was the central question that Philip K. Dick was obsessed with. Was Dick an influence on your movie in any way?
For sure. I mean, not that I can recall specifically, but I mean, I'm a massive Philip K. Dick fan and have been forever. So he's one of those influences that can't help but creep his way into whatever I happen to be working on, I'm sure. Absolutely.
Yeah. I understand that the production process for The Empty Man was not without its challenges, and that's probably putting it mildly. Can you tell us about that whole experience?
Yeah. So, I mean, we were beset by the usual sorts of things that happen to any movie. We had locations that were inaccessible, so we had to build roads in to get them. We had weather problems. There was a day of riots one time in Cape Town that changed our shooting schedule. And then we got to Chicago to finish out the shoot. You know, we did 50 something days in Cape Town, and then we came to Illinois to wrap it up with about a week of exterior shooting. And we were south of the equator 2 days before in South African springtime, and we arrived in December in Chicago and got 2 feet of snow on the ground. So,
oh wow,
we had to shut down. We did a couple of days in frigid Chicago weather before it just became impossible. I mean, the other thing that had happened during that was our costumes had been held up at customs. And so our Illinois crew was working around the clock, our wardrobe people trying to figure out how to double these costumes in a record time because we just couldn't get them out of customs. It was madness. So we shut down for a little while. Then our executive at Fox, who was our lead advocate within the system, left the studio. We were kind of abandoned. It was an interesting thing because I think we were cheap enough that we weren't drawing enough attention. And it took them a while to replace our previous executive. And anytime that happens, it's precarious. I mean, anybody who's read the briefest overview of Terry Gilliam's career kind of knows what you're in for when something like this happens. We didn't have it as bad as Baron Munchausen, but we had, you know, we had some problem. And so, you know, by the time it got to the, you know, the people who inherited the movie just had no vested interest in it whatsoever. And it was a thing that required a kid glove treatment. That was the thing that we'd always knew going in, was that if we're really stupid, we're going to market this like a teen thriller and it's going to die. That ended up what happened.
He finds you. You can hear him, can't you? Squirming his way into your thoughts. Like a disease. And his message is contagious.
By the time the trailer was being made, the Disney acquisition was complete. I didn't even see the trailer until the day before it came out. If it would have done any good, I would have objected, but there was nothing, you know, they didn't care. They released the poster and the one sheet 1 week before the film came out. It was like overtly insulting. They were trying to make absolutely sure that nobody could ever mistake them for having supported the movie. They wanted to be on record for we think this is trash. And they made that statement very, very clearly.
Now that The Empty Man is out and has received some really great reviews, what are your emotions about the whole experience of making this film? How do you feel about it?
It took so long And the attitude from my ostensible supporters, of the people who paid for it, was so negative for so long. I shame to admit I had absorbed a lot of that negativity myself. And when I finished the film, I had never seen final picture and final sound together because of just the nature of the bit of post-production. I approved final picture to temp sound, and I approved final sound to temp picture, but I'd never seen them married until it came out in October. And I bought a ticket to see it in Long Beach. And I came out of it refreshed because it wasn't bad. I had really become half convinced that they were right and that I had just really screwed up. But I thought, well, if nothing else, I like it. And then it kind of started to turn around online.
Now, if you don't like The Empty Man, that's totally fine. I'm not here to tell you you're wrong. I'm just here to share my thoughts on a film that has been passed over by many people, and a film that was treated very badly in its release, and a film that I think in years to come will have a considerable cult following, and I think it deserves it.
I never thought in a million years I would say thank God for film Twitter, but thank God for film Twitter.
Yeah.
And Letterboxd. I mean, and you know, it's again, it's been said before, but I mean, there's something probably in the nature of finding something that's been discarded and picking it up and dusting it off and going, hey, I kind of like this, that makes you take ownership of it in a way that inspires more personal devotion than something that had been really cleverly marketed to you.
Mm-hmm. You got your break directing DVD special features for David Fincher films like Zodiac and The Social Network. Were you able to draw on those experiences in any way while you were directing The Empty Man?
Well, anytime you spend hanging around a set with David Fincher or Peter Weir or any number of the other people that I've been able to hang around the set with, it's always going to be valuable. It's often said that it's a curious thing being a director because very few directors work their way up through the business like they used to. A lot of directors come straight out of school or they've done a short or they've made commercials or something like that. And so you don't often see other directors work. A lot of directors don't know how other directors do it. They've just figured out their own path. And so it has been a very interesting, certainly beneficial bird's eye view of how other people work a set. But you can't ever do it except the way that you do it. It's not possible, I don't think, to adopt another director's methodology because mm-hmm. it has to be organic to you and you have to be able to live in it and back it up. So there's a lot of practical uses watching the way that somebody like Fincher will divide his time. But again, Fincher's working at a level that very few other directors get to work at. So, you know, if he needs to shoot for 125 days, he's going to shoot for 125 days. That's not an option that's open to a lot of other people. So you have to always bear in mind there's a kind of utility that you can take from that, and then there's a kind that's not open to you yet.
Yeah, for sure. What's next for you?
There's a couple of things on the horizon. I'm doing a thing I've been working on a show with Fincher for Netflix for a little while, a film kind of appreciation show that we hopefully will unveil soon.
Oh, cool.
And I've got a couple of scripts of my own that I'm hoping to go out with fairly soon.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll look forward to those. And I hope your next filmmaking experience is a much more pleasant one.
Thank you. I hope so, too. I mean, you know, Guillermo del Toro called out of the blue the other day and was enormously also supportive and flattering about it and said that he was so offended by the way the film was treated that I think he said he thought it was his moral duty to try to make sure that doesn't ever happen again. So that was nice.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. That's great. He's right. It's a wonder. It's a great film. Thank you very much, David Pryor. It was so great to have a chance to talk to you.
Oh, thank you, Doug. It was my pleasure. Appreciate it.
David Pryor is the writer and director of the horror film, The Empty Man. Find out more at WPR.org/beta.
They all feel like they're on the sidelines of things. They're kind of lurking on the sidelines and looking upon their neighbors as being the main action.
Coming up, novelist and film director Sandy Tan joins us to talk about her novel Lurkers and her documentary Shirkers. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
I know I was doing things backwards. First, I made a movie. Then I became a film critic. Then I went to film school. But that's what happens when you no longer have a map.
That's a clip from Sandy Tan's award-winning feature documentary, Shirkers. The doc explores a narrative film that Sandy made with her friends in 1992, when she was only 19 and living in her native Singapore. After production wrapped, her mysterious mentor left with the footage, and Sandy never saw him again. Her lost film became somewhat of an urban legend in Singapore. Sandy is not only a filmmaker and a film critic, she's also a novelist. Her latest book is called Lurkers. It focuses on a cast of people in a suburban Los Angeles neighborhood and what happens when their lives intersect in very intriguing ways. We connected with Sandy to find out how she's able to be so creative in both fiction and film. She explains that growing up, she would daydream and create thought experiments and stories for the people she observed. That process was also at the heart of Lurkers.
Well, I began writing this book, let's say, in 2006, I guess, around that time, when I just moved, not long after I've just moved into this suburban neighborhood north of LA. It was a few years after 9/11, and, you know, there was still this great feeling of, I don't know, paranoia in the air and you know, waiting for the other shoe to drop. And I had moved to this kind of very placid neighborhood, kind of in North Pasadena, Altadena, north of LA, northeast of LA. And I was trying to, I had to imagine the neighborhood to be more interesting than I thought it might be, in order for me to feel comfortable and feel like I wanted to be there. So I started to kind of think about, imagine myself into the lives of those around me. And what would happen if these lives collided somehow? You know, like, because I felt like everybody lived in a different genre of movie, maybe. You know, they were inhabiting a different kind of movie or a different TV show. And what would happen if these people collided, their lives collided, and what new hybrids would emerge from that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I've read that you have said the easiest way for you to create characters, to get to know the characters you're writing about, is to imagine your way into their heads. And I'm curious to know, is that always the way you create characters, by imagining your way into their heads?
Yeah, I don't know how else to. I guess, you know, some of them start from the outside, you know, like, for instance, Raymond, the aging novelist, then he's getting old and feeling slightly irrelevant. And he was kind of inspired by a famous novelist friend that I had many years ago, whose homes I had visited. And they were, you know, spectacular. He was a successful novelist. So he had those homes that were done in the kind of 1940s film noir style. And he had like these marvelous mahogany bookcases around in his house. But when you went closer and examined them, like every single book on those bookcases were his own. And I thought, I just filed that away, and I just thought, I must use that somewhere because this is so good. And he's just built himself a prison of himself. And maybe he wanted that, but maybe he, I don't know, whether it was for self-preservation or vanity or what. I mean, you know, self-affirmation or what. But I just thought, what an interesting prison, and how interesting to, I mean, what fun it would be to get inside that head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And it was fun reading about him. I think he was probably, well, all the characters are very intriguing, but I think he was definitely one of my favorites. I think,
oh, yeah. He's my favorite.
Yeah. Oh, really? Yeah. Because for me, it's because I love horror novels. And since he writes horror novels, why is he your favorite?
I don't know. I think maybe because I was writing, and maybe because I'm aging, and maybe because I dislike people. I don't know. There's a lot of me in him. There's a lot of me in every one of them, you know, different aspects of myself. So I kind of lie when I say I'm kind of thinking myself into their heads, because, you know, how can you escape yourself, really? So there's aspects of me in all of them. And I just could use him. I could more freely put myself into him, because I felt like I could get inside the head of a writer more easily than maybe a teenage girl. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. That makes sense. You mentioned you hate people. Do you really?
Well, you know.
Yeah. Okay, maybe sort of like Jean-Paul Sartre, hell is other people, depending on who the person is, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, I say that, but I've been, now that COVID is lifting, and somehow very fond of people all of a sudden again, and seeing a lot of my friends, you know, like suddenly all of us, you know, people who just normally do not like other people are suddenly very social and very friendly.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me that most of these characters, maybe even all of them, are restless and dissatisfied with their lives. They want to live different lives, but they're not willing to make the changes required to do that, which I guess makes them lurkers, like the title of your novel. How do you view your characters?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. You know, they all feel like they're on the sidelines of things. They're kind of lurking on the sidelines and looking upon their neighbors as being the main action, you know. Everybody never feels like they're part of the main action, but that it's always over there. And in the suburban neighborhood, you're often just looking across the fence into somebody else's yard, or looking across the street and watching this lonely person in the window at night drinking by himself or drinking by herself, and just imagining some kind of kinship with that person, even though it may not exist. So, you know, so much of their, I guess, when you live in a neighborhood that's filled with people who are inside the houses. It's a very COVID-friendly book, I guess.
Where
you know, people aren't interacting so much, but they're often imagining the lives of people around them. And then when they do actually interact, it often doesn't happen in the ways that they might have imagined things would happen.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, as the plot progresses, many of these characters' lives intersect in these very interesting ways. I'm curious, did you map out these intersections before you started writing lurkers, or did they come up to you while you were writing?
I mean, I knew that they were living so close to each other that they at some point would have to interact, and things would echo, you know, there would be motifs that kind of ran throughout the book, and, you know, the way people collided into somebody's life would happen maybe in similar ways at different times. So that kind of thing, I kind of liked playing with echoes and mirror, doubles and things like that, and mistaken identities. But it was pretty much organic, I think.
Mm-hmm. Lurkers contain some very dark subject matter, but you also include a lot of dark comedy. Did you include the dark comedy to make the disturbing parts of the book easier to take?
Yeah, well, I don't know about easier to take, but my natural impulse is always towards comedy, I think. And so I have a dark sense of humor, so I do want to, you know, introduce some of those darker themes, but yeah, I guess you want to leaven it with levity.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and you do it very well. Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
Let's shift gears and talk about your 2018 documentary, Shirkers. For those of our listeners who may not have seen it, what's it about?
When I was a teenager in Singapore, just me and my friends who were teenagers making a film called Shirkers, which was about a teenage assassin played by me. And then this film that was shot in 16mm in 1992 was stolen by our mentor, this mysterious self-avowed American who's actually from Colombia. And then he stole this film, destroyed our lives, vanished. And then years later, I've moved to the US, I've grown up, I recover the footage of this lost film, and I make a film about this whole process. George was nowhere to be seen or heard, except here. And so I was the screenwriter, Sophie was the producer, Jasmine would be the editor, and George was the director.
George Cardona, who looms so large, as you mentioned, he's the mentor, he looms so large in the film. Is he by any chance the inspiration for the creepy drama teacher character, Mr. Z, in your novel?
Yes, he is. Yeah. I would say, yeah, I was just,
yeah.
He's one of them, he might be the primary one, but he's one of several inspirations for that character. You know, writing him was a way of kind of completing a conversation that wasn't quite completed, or has aspects of conversations that he and I have had. So I'm writing with intimate knowledge of what it's like to talk to a man who would tell you things and then pretend he didn't say it.
Right.
You know, just to mess with you. George was like no other adult I knew in Singapore. He liked to just sit and watch the light change. He took us to shoot colorful Hindu festivals that my family would have found frightening. He talked about movies the way I wanted to talk about movies. He loved the French New Wave. And soon,
So did I.
How did making Shirkers affect you in terms of moving forward with your career as an artist?
It was a great thing because it showed that I wasn't lying about this thing that happened to me, first of all, and that it showed that I knew how to tell the story, even though it was a great challenge to tell the story with almost hardly any kind of, you know, footage of the villain. It required a lot of getting interviews from people who didn't want to be interviewed and didn't want to think about this episode that happened 20 years ago because it was still painful for them. And being able to tell all our stories, I think, was supremely cathartic for me and for them.
I secured a meeting with a high-profile person, and it took me a lot of time and courage. And before the person arrived, George said to me, "Okay, now you go into the kitchen. I'm going to take the meeting." That was a very difficult moment for me. I didn't believe in George. I did not believe in George, but I believed in the film. Do I yell at George, or is it better for me to remain in the kitchen and have him secure the deal so the film could move forward? And I chose the film.
The fact that, you know, we made this film and it was hugely beloved around the world, it was a very good thing because the stories that I tend to want to tell tend to be slightly more complex and convoluted. And the fact that I could kind of pull a compelling narrative out of what many thought was an impossible story to tell was actually a very good thing to have in my pocket.
Definitely, yeah. And you mentioned the Shirkers was hugely beloved. When it premiered at Sundance in 2018, you won the World Cinema Documentary Directing Award. And the New Yorker film critic Richard Brody has said that it's one of the best documentaries of all time. Why do you think the film has struck such a chord with so many people?
Because I think I invited them into the story and everybody felt it was their own. Because I think that's an aspect of a lot of people who felt like something was stolen from them, or, you know, in terms of unfinished business, because I thought of this whole stolen film and having to deal with it thing, broken friendships thing, was a huge chunk of unfinished business in my life that I had to go back and redo and do it right. And a lot of people feel that it's personal to them too, because even though it's supremely specific to my experience, maybe because of it, it felt very universal to a lot of people. And you know, I get people still writing to me all the time from, like, I just had this kid write to me from Colombia, and I often get kids from Latin America writing to me and you know, with tearful emojis and saying, "This is my story," mm-hmm. too, or people feeling like now they have the courage to go back and finish the thing they didn't finish before, you know, the work or something. And my whole thing is that it's never too late, and I just want people to know that it's completely fine. You're not alone. That's my main message, and I think that kind of resonates.
Very well said. You joked on Twitter that with your movie Shirkers and your novel Lurkers, that there's not going to be an album called Twerkers coming next. But what is next for you?
I am working on a series of things some of which I can talk about and some of which I can't, as usual, in that boring, boring, boring way. I am working to make the film adaptation of Elif Batuman's The Idiot, her 2017 best-selling novel, The Idiot, not to be confused with Dostoevsky's The Idiot. And I've written the screenplay, and we're in the process of kind of getting to make the movie. And that's one of the things I'm pursuing.
Yeah, and I understand that my all-time favorite film, Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo, is kind of an influence on the way you see
yeah,
The Idiot.
A little bit. It's a great, funny coming-of-age story about a very smart young woman who is, I guess, head smart and heart stupid, silly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, like in Vertigo, the movie, you have Scotty, who's kind of obsessed with this unattainable woman. And in The Idiot, you have a very smart young woman, Celine, who is obsessed with this boy, and except she doesn't know she's obsessed with him, even though you watch her life just kind of disintegrate as she loses her friends and just kind of ignores them and neglects them while pursuing this boy, even though she doesn't think of herself as pursuing him. She is clearly obsessed that she goes off to Hungary in search of him.
Excellent. Sandy Tan, thank you very much for this great conversation.
Thank you. This is really, really fun to talk to you.
Sandy Tan is the writer and director of the award-winning documentary Shirkers and the author of the novel Lurkers. Find out more about Sandy, Shirkers, and Lurkers at wpr.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Jen Spira, Sandy Tan, and David Pryor. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta Podcast. It's available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Just search for Wisconsin Public Radio and Beta. You can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
If you say your name enough times, it becomes gibberish.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
Aren't you a little young for the Neil Cassidy routine?
And thanks to you, our alphas. We'll see you next week. I'm Doug Gordon.
He transmits, we receive. And his message is contagious.